Sisters and brothers in the Dharma, Namo Buddhaya, Jai Bhim.
Jai Bhim.
So, welcome everybody who's watching this online to Padmaloka. Welcome to our day retreat, or a bit of our day retreat. It's a special day retreat today. We're having a completely silent practice day, apart from this talk. And this is all part of our Vaishakha Purnima, Vaisak, Buddha Jayanti, Buddha Day celebrations, and tomorrow we'll be celebrating that in many different ways. And already we have our shrine room and our shrine beautifully adorned with wonderful flowers and blossoms from the garden. It really is very, very beautiful here at Padmaloka. It's a very, very beautiful spring. It's very bright, it's very sunny, if a little bit cool, but the lilac is in full bloom, the wisteria is in full bloom. There are all kinds of blossoming trees and flowers. It really is very beautiful here. And the community, the 18-man Padmaloka community, is also very beautiful. We're all getting on very well, practicing the Dharma together, keeping Padmaloka well tended, and studying and spending time together, as well as keeping up with people online and keeping abreast of events in the world. I think it's true to say that all of us are longing for the day when people can come to Padmaloka again and we can go out and about to communicate the Dharma again. I think we're really missing that, even though we're in wonderful conditions at the same time. We're really feeling it. We really want to communicate and communicate face to face and be with people. Personally, I couldn't quite work out why I was feeling a little bit, not exactly down, but certainly a little bit, a little bit sad, I think. And I think it's that. It's wonderful being here. We're blessed to live with one another. But there is a certain sadness at not being able to be with people face to face, being to being, communicating the Dharma more widely. And we can do it to some extent online, but nothing really replaces actually being with people. We're profoundly social creatures, human beings, and we want and need to be together, even though there are great benefits to be had from this period of solitude. And today's talk is on Kshanti Paramita, the perfection of patience. And I must admit, I found this, as the Bodhicharavatara has gone on, I'm finding it more and more difficult to prepare the talks, partly because of the length of the chapters and the subtlety of Shantideva's argument, partly because of the subject matter. Kshanti, I think, is a particularly profound virtue, certainly for me, even on the sort of ordinary human level, leaving aside the perfection of Kshanti. It's not an easy one. And in correspondence with somebody recently who was rejoicing in these talks, I had to admit to always feeling, both before and after the talks, mostly discomfort and dissatisfaction. I know one shouldn't say this before a talk, but, you know, Shantideva does do really good confession, so here's one from me. And I think what it is, I think studying Shantideva in these conditions and studying in order to communicate what he says to the extent that I can more widely, it's a bit like, it's reminding me a bit of the first long seminar I did with Bhante, with Sangharakshita. Being with Shantideva in this way is like being with a great teacher who's constantly showing you the Dharma, and in doing that is mirroring you to yourself. And that's as well as it, as much as it's inspirational, it's also profoundly humiliating. And I know many people, when they've studied the Bodhicharavatara intensively, have put off for life. Don't be put off. I've never been put off. It's just that we have to accept, patiently accept, that this is profound Dharma. And, you know, it will, in a sense, hurt us. it will be a bit painful, as well as uplift us. So that said, let's hear his opening verses of 134 verses. Don't worry, we won't be going through every 134 verses, just a few highlights. So the perfection of patience. Hatred destroys all the good conduct, generosity and worship of the Buddhas performed throughout thousands of eons. There is no evil like hatred and no spiritual practice equal to patience. Therefore, one should develop patience by various means, with great effort. A man with the dart of hatred in his heart finds no peace, neither enjoys pleasure or delight. He does not feel secure and does not sleep well. Those who he honours with wealth and respect, and also his dependents, even they want to hurt the master who is disfigured by hatred. Even friends shrink from him. The man with hatred gives but is not respected. In short, there is no way that an angry man can be happy. The person who realizes that hatred is an enemy, since it creates such sufferings as these, and who persistently strikes their hatred down, is happy in this world and the next. Consuming the food of dejection, prepared by doing the undesirable, biting hatred strikes me down. Therefore I shall destroy the food of this deceiver, since this hatred has no purpose other than my murder. So, just a few general points about Kshanti. Wonderfully stirring verses there, I think, on the perils of hatred. Kshanti can be translated as patience or forbearance. When Bhante has expounded Kshanti Paramita, he says that patience, Kshanti, has connotations of tolerance, receptivity and love. And we'll see that Kshanti Deva does actually cover many of these meanings in his discussion of Kshanti. It's very clear from these eight verses how perilous hatred, ill will, anger, retaliation and resentment are. Just for a human being, leaving aside a bodhisattva vowed to save all living beings. Hatred, anger, resentment, all these emotions are corrosive and damaging to our human life and our human development, our human well-being, and even our social standing and friendships. And we really need to really take that on board. Be very, very clear about that in our mind. There is no virtue in any of these emotions. For the bodhisattva, breaking precepts, it said, out of hatred or anger is far worse than breaking precepts out of craving, because, as I think the Ratnakuta Sutra says, or in the Ratnakuta collection, if you break a fault out of craving, you still hold sentient beings in your embrace. But if you break a precept out of hatred, you alienate yourself from sentient beings. And of course, you're disrupting what you're really trying to do, which is practice enlightenment for the liberation of all. So it's a very, very serious fault. Kshanti Deva actually uses various words in his texts which can be translated as hatred or in other ways. So dvesha, I think, is the most common. I haven't counted them up. Dvesha meaning hatred, ill will. Then there is pratiga, which again can be translated as hatred, but it's violence. It means striking down, doing real harm to others. That is what destroys all the merit that you've done. And then there's krodha. Krodha can be translated as anger and wrath. Sometimes when we're studying the perfection of patience or texts like it, people immediately bring up a distinction between anger and hatred. And anger can be okay, but hatred isn't okay. That's the argument that's used. But what they mean, of course, by anger is a sort of creative breaking through obstacles that have been dammed up. It's not anger in the sense of harming other people. It's very easy to misunderstand this point. I've heard many people use this as a rationalisation for their bad temper. You know, my anger is sort of breaking through, but it's actually a rationalisation for their irascibility and bad temper, which definitely harms and alienates people. Shantideva is talking about all those emotions that harm and alienate people from you. Hatred, anger, wrath, ill will, you know, all of those responses, all of those expressions. There's nothing good in any of it. Anything that is harming others, there's nothing good in any of it. And I think we really need to be very, very clear about that. You know, I think sometimes, you know, we still have the legacy of sort of therapeutic approaches, if you like, that sort of getting stuff out is a good thing, even if it harms others. And I think that does need to be looked at. It does need to be really considered. Shantideva would not accept that kind of argument. So verse 1 makes it very clear. Hatred, and this is being translated here as pratiga, destroys all the good conduct, generosity and worship of the Buddhas performed throughout thousands of eons. I mean, is Shantideva being rhetorical? You know, that sometimes they go further and say it's one moment of hatred, one moment of loss of temper can destroy all the good that you've done. Surely not all of the wonderful efforts you've made. But certainly I must admit, when I lose it on occasion, I do feel I've lost everything. I've lost a lot, certainly. That's what it feels like. And I wonder if that's what he's talking about. And of course, sometimes if you lose it, it can create so many other problems, so many other issues, so many karmic consequences come from that, that it might well undermine all the positive efforts that you've made for such a long time. So we need to be really, you know, careful. A man with the dart of hatred in his heart finds no peace, neither enjoys pleasure or delight. He does not feel secure, and he does not sleep well. It's worth pondering here. It's really good human wisdom. Those who he honours with wealth and respect, and also his dependents, even they want to hurt the master who is disfigured by hatred. So you might be benefiting people in so many ways, but if there is hatred, you know, and it might not be just that hot hatred, it might be a sort of cold hatred, a kind of aloof hatred, which is just as bad, if not worse. They won't want to be with you. They won't want to be with you. Sometimes, you know, I know people who have sort of got, you know, long-standing, you know, sort of resentment issues, and that's a sort of major part of their discourse. And they wonder why people don't want to be with them. Well, it's obvious why people don't want to be with them. Nobody wants to be on the end of that narrative. Even friends shrink from him. The man with hatred gives but is not respected. In short, there is no way that an angry man can be happy. Even friends shrink from him. And there's a story which I've told before, but I love telling it because it was one of the greatest teachings I've ever received in my life. I lived in India for many years, and I used to do a lot of retreats at Bhaja and a lot of Dharma activity with Indian order members. And unfortunately, I used to lose my temper. You know, sometimes, you know, when arrangements weren't being made properly and not organized properly, and, you know, things can go wrong and so on, seemingly more in India than perhaps in other places. Or it seemed like that to me, or it was my, you know, my cultural expectations, if you like, being disappointed. And, I remember one order meeting on a retreat, something had happened, I don't know what, and I went off on one. I went off on one and I was speaking very strongly. And the next day, Amoga Ditya, who was just recently ordained, and I am his Kalyana Mitra. We were having lunch together and he said, "You shouldn't talk like that, Padmavajra." His English is not that good, but he's a very direct speaker. He's a night watchman, Amoga Ditya, a guard. And that's what he was doing in those days. I think he's the men's Mitra convener in Bombay now. He just said, "Nope, you can't speak like that. That's really bad. And I said, but, you know, Moggaditya, people have to understand that... Da, 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 da. He said, no, Padmavajra, you can't speak like that. If you speak like that, people will stay away from you and then you can't benefit them. And it was one of those moments where, I was speechless. He was telling me that I had a good effect, and he was telling me, when you're like this, people stay away and you can't benefit them. Brilliant, clear teaching. That's what happens. And it's true. You know, our bad temper, can keep people away from the good, that we do, because people can't relax, they can't trust you, they don't know when you're going to blow up, and so on. So, Shantideva has got real insight, I think, here into the dynamics of communication. So the Bodhisattva needs to perfect Kshanti Paramita, because he's profoundly involved with people, with life. He wants the enlightenment of all beings. In other traditions, Shantideva doesn't talk about this so much in the Bodhicharyavatara, but I'm sure he would have been aware of it. You have the ethics of gathering a community, as it's called. The Parigraha Gana Shila, the ethics of gathering a community of people. That's what the Bodhisattva practices. He creates a spiritual community, as Bhante says in the Vimalakirti Nidesha series. The Bodhisattva gathers a community so that together, through their combined efforts, they can purify the Buddha field. They can build a Buddha land. They can build an environment, a world, which is entirely conducive to practice. So a Bodhisattva is going to be involved with people. He's going to get close to people. A Bodhisattva doesn't come down from on high, gives a few teachings, and then goes away. That's not what happens here. That's too easy. That's not what it's like. A Bodhisattva is profoundly involved with communities of people. He's part of a community, wants to create a community. That's very, very demanding, unless you're very highly developed. Very demanding indeed, that kind of life, that kind of world. And, it's worth, reflecting with Buddha Day almost upon us, that after his great enlightenment, well, as Bhante says, enlightenment isn't one experience, it's a whole unfolding of experiences. And there's this moment after the Buddha's great vision of life where he wonders if he can teach, if he can communicate. It's a very mysterious passage that I still think requires great reflection. He wonders, this Dhamma, this reality that I've discovered, this truth is so profound, so deep, so subtle. If I were to communicate that to others and they did not understand, that would be wearying for me. That would be wearying for me. That would be troubling for me. And he was inclined not to act. Of course, the story goes on with Brahma's request and, the emergence of great compassion. But I think, actually, and there are many interpretations of this story, but perhaps it's a bit of a message, to the would-be helper of others, the would-be aspiring Bodhisattva. Well, be careful what you wish for, because you're going to get really involved with people. You're going to be involved in their lives. Make sure that you have the patience, the strength of patience to be able to do that well, to be able to do that properly. In verse 2 of the section that I read at the beginning, you have, there is no evil like hatred and no spiritual practice equal to patience. This is a reflection of a verse from the Dhammapada. Kanti paramang tapo titika. Kanti paramang tapo titika. Patience, forbearance, is the supreme asceticism. It's the supreme ascetic practice. It's the supreme tapasya. And of course, the Buddha knew all about what extreme ascetic practice was. He was a tapasi. himself, who was, really harming his body. He rejected, of course, that approach to things. But what he says in this verse in the Dhammapada, which Shantideva quotes, the real, the perfect asceticism is the perfect spiritual practice, is the practice of patience. That's the highest spiritual practice. You don't need to harm yourself any more than just be in this world, practicing the Dharma for others and with others. That is the great asceticism. That's the way you're going to make heat. This is the meaning of tapas, the making of heat, the making of spiritual heat. So to refrain from hatred, anger, resentment, blame, irritation, a retaliation in the face of hardship, in the face of attack, in the face of enemies and injustice or their indifference, all that, all the refraining from all that, forbearing in relation to all that, that is the highest spiritual practice, the highest ascetic practice. If we give in to reactive responses, just like ordinary worldly people, we're no different from anybody else, no matter how noble our aspiration. It can almost seem sometimes the sort of irritations and sort of annoyance that we can have as Buddhists in relation to sort of Buddhist matters is as though we're exempting ourselves from the practice of patience. But we're, to the extent that we're reacting in that way, we're just like everybody else. We're no different. There's nothing distinctive about what we're doing. Shanti Paramita makes the Buddhist community distinctive in the way it conducts its affairs and in the way we individually practice. Verses 7 and 8 indicate the conditions for hatred. Shantideva says, consuming the food of dejection, prepared by doing the undesirable, biting hatred strikes me down. Therefore I shall destroy the food of this deceiver, since this hatred has no purpose other than my murder. He likes his strong language, doesn't he? Hatred has no other purpose than my murder, not the murder of others, my murder. But it's this consuming the food of dejection, feeding on doramanasya, in Pali domanasa, which is dejection, melancholy, which comes through frustrated desire, frustrated craving. This food of dejection is prepared by doing what is undesirable, being put together with what we don't want, having what we don't want taken away from us, frustrated desire. It's feeding on unsatisfied desires, unsatisfied craving that is the cause of hatred. Getting what you don't want, doing what you don't want to do. We need to destroy that food. We need to stop consuming that food. It's interesting, the word for food is ahara. And there's very interesting discussions of food, which we don't have time to go into. It's not just ordinary food, it's nourishment that comes through the senses, or what we brood on. How do we nourish ourselves internally as well as externally? We even, people feed on their anger, feed on their resentment, feed on their disappointment. That's all got to stop. That's all got to end if we want to practice Shanti Paramita. We have to really do something about that. We have to get to the root of things. So what to do by way of response? How do we stop feeding on the food of dejection? So here's a couple of verses, 9 and 10, which follow these. In order to practice patience, I will work on not disturbing the feeling of sympathetic joy, even at the arrival of something extremely unwelcome. There is nothing worthwhile in the state of dejection. On the contrary, in that state the skillful is neglected. If there is a solution, then what is the point of dejection? If there is no solution, then what is the point of dejection? So first of all, there's this wonderful verse. In order to practice patience and to turn away from dejection, I will work on not disturbing the feeling of sympathetic joy, even at the arrival of something extremely unwelcome. This is really, really important, this constant development of sympathetic joy, of mudita. It's a big, big feature in the tradition. You know, really working on your sympathetic joy, working on that rejoicing in others, rejoicing in the good and the wholesome. It's interesting, isn't it, that what opens up to the Buddha after Brahma's request, when he looks at the world, it says he has compassion, but it's a response to beauty. It's seeing all living beings like lotus flowers in that great lake. And there's a sense that his compassion, if you can call it that, his anukampa, his trembling with, is really responding to the good and the beautiful emerging in others. That enables him to teach. And you notice as soon as he has that vision, the Buddha is out there. He's communicating. And where does he go first? He goes to those fellow tapasis, those fellow ascetics who scorn him for taking a little bit of food. That's who he goes to first. And he reflects, they were very helpful to me. They were very helpful to me. He rejoices in their helpfulness. Maybe they will see. So we really need to work on this mudita. If we suffer from dejection and therefore we suffer from ill will, we really have to practice mudita very, very strongly. Perhaps we can do that in a number of ways. One of the main ways that is recommended very strongly in the tradition is constant recollection of the qualities of the three jewels and the bodhisattvas, constantly bringing them to mind. We really have to, you know, not be miserable, moaning and complaining Buddhists. You know, I think there's far too much self-indulgent misery and moaning and complaining within the Buddhist community. I mean, it really is dreadful. It's embarrassing and shameful how much moaning there is. But that means, I think, that the three jewels are not rejoiced in. Fact is, we have the three jewels. We have a great teacher. We have a great community. Yes, we can usually add at this point, yes, but there are faults. Let's just stop that, you know, business of, yes, there are faults. Let's rejoice wholeheartedly in what we have. Really wholeheartedly. If you can't, well, I think you're in difficulty because you're just going to be feeding disappointment and dejection. And it's going to harm you and there will be no progress. So we need to rejoice and really push back any kind of sense that we're somehow, denied access to wonderful things, and therefore we feel it's okay to be miserable and moan and complain. Many years ago, I was listening to the BBC. BBC radio can be wonderful, can't it? And it was a program, I think, called World Roots. And there was an interview with a great Afghani Qawwali singer named Ahmad Sham. He was in the studio with his Qawwali party and they were singing. And of course, when the Taliban came into Kabul, they went to the area of music where there was wonderful music played, where the Qawwalis live, and they arrested everybody, imprisoned everybody, and treated them very, very badly because, you know, the Taliban, you know, think there should not be any music in Islam, whereas the Qawwalis say, well, music is the way of celebrating reality, celebrating the Lord. And he was asked, well, what was that like? And he said, ah, we have a saying in our Sufi tradition that when the house is taken off the roof, it means that the sun and the sky are really open. And you can really see, the sun can shine in fully. In the same way, when everything is taken away from you, it means that Allah can enter our lives more fully, and his blessings and grace can descend upon us more fully, the more they beat us, the louder we sang. The more they beat us, the louder they sang of their joy in what they had been given. Well, if that's true of a devout, mystical Muslim, and if you want to hear, you know, one of his best songs, try Rai Mai Khana O Masjid, the way to the mosque and the wine house. The wine house being the Sufi meeting house. Listen to that, it's fabulous. The more they beat us, the louder we sang. Well, if this is true of a mystical Muslim, and apparently we've got the truth, we've got reality, we have the Dharma, why can't we be like that? In the face of the tiniest things that go wrong, where is our joy, our ecstatic joy at what we've been given, at what we have? It really does beg the question, doesn't it? And then in these verses, there's that lovely, very famous line, which I gather is one of the Dalai Lama's most favoured meditations. If there is a solution, then what is the point of dejection? There's no need for dejection if you have a solution to a problem that you're facing. If there is no solution, what is the point of dejection? There's still no point in that dejection. It's still going to harm you. It doesn't do any good, that anxiety, that dejection. If there is a solution, then what is the point of dejection? If there is no solution, what is the point of dejection? Perhaps that little verse, we should have it as a sort of maxim during this time. Because it is a very frustrating time and dejection can arise. We need to let go of that. We need to do everything that we can to relax and be calm and to release anxiety and fear. Anxiety causes so much aggro, doesn't it? So much aggression and bad temper. And I see it in myself. When I'm anxious, I get snappy. You know, I'm immediately sort of flinging out little darts which sort of wound people. Well, that's no good. Anxiety can often be to do with this feeling of dejection and frustration. Lovely word in Marathi when people are getting all excited and uptight. Shantraha. Shantraha. Peace. Yeah, calm. Calm down, as we might say. But sometimes we say calm down with an anxious voice, don't we? But if there is anxiety and those kinds of emotions, we have to ask ourselves, well, then where is the refuge? Where is the deep reliance? Because if we are going for refuge, we can rest on the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. We can entrust ourselves to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. There is no need for anxiety or dejection. There's no need for this sort of anxious concern. In a commentary on the Bodhicharavatara, right at the beginning of it, a Nyingma Pa, traditional Nyingma Pa commentary, there's a wonderful quote, the three terrible oaths of Dorje Drollo. Dorje Drollo being the very, very sublimely wrathful form of Padmasambhava. And the three terrible oaths are, whatever has to happen, let it happen. Whatever the situation is, that's fine. I really don't need anything. Great contentment, because you have the refuges. You're resting in the refuges. The next set of verses, Shantideva goes through a number of objects, if you like, external things that we need to be practicing patient towards. The next verses are the patient acceptance of the sufferings which are woven into life, the dukkha of life. So let me just read a few of these. Happiness is scarce. Suffering persists with no effort. But only through suffering is there escape. Therefore, mind, be strong. Incarnata, the devotees of Durga, willingly endure to no purpose the pain of burns, cuts, and worse. Why then am I a coward when my goal is liberation. There is nothing which remains difficult if it is practice. So through practice with minor discomforts, even major discomfort becomes bearable. The irritation of bugs, gnats and mosquitoes, of hunger and thirst, and discomfort such as an enormous itch. Why do you not see them as insignificant? Cold, heat, rain and wind, journeying and sickness, imprisonment and beatings. One should not be too squeamish about them. Otherwise the distress becomes worse. This comes from the bravery or cowardice of the mind. Therefore one should become invincible to suffering and overpower discomfort. Not even in suffering should a wise person allow his serene confidence of mind to be disturbed. For the battle is with the defilements, and in warfare pain is easily won. The virtue of suffering has no rival, since from the shock it causes, intoxication falls away, and there arises compassion for those in cyclic existence, fear of evil, and longing for the conqueror. So he's saying that we need to learn to bear the manifold sufferings that go with life. And he's saying, look, suffering is probably actually going to be more common than happiness. In a way, I find that a great relief, that line. Because we can sometimes have this idea, you have to be happy all the time. And if you're not happy, something's really wrong. You've got to have pleasure all the time. And if you're not having that, something's wrong. Hey, chill out. You know, suffering happens. It's everywhere. Happiness is a real achievement. That comes from the fruit of living a life well lived, properly lived. So we've got to bear, we're always going to have to bear some dukkha. Even the Buddha, after his enlightenment, had to bear the dukkha of physical pain. Not the other kinds of pain, but he had to bear that. You don't get away from that. He talks about developing this serene confidence of mind, this prasada citta of mind, of heart. Prasada means clearness, brightness, lucidity, purity, calmness, tranquility, good humour, confidence, all those things. And it's associated with faith. It's a kind of faith. It's the faith that is likened, this mind comes when you really contemplate the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And they say that this faith is like a water purifying gem that purifies all the mud and impurities in the water so that the water becomes clear and bright and drinkable. So we need to contemplate the qualities of the three jewels throughout the day. Keeping those qualities alive so we develop this calmness, this serenity, this confidence in whatever is thrown at us. So he also refers to the ascetics down in Karnataka, the devotees of Durga who harm themselves. And he's saying, well, look at what they do for no reason. Why can't you put up with stuff when you're on the path to liberation, which is not like that? They really go for it, really hurt themselves. You don't need to do that. You just have life, you have practice, you have other people. Bear it. Bear it. So often in the Pali texts, you find little suttas. I think they're very significant, where the Buddha is watching a monk or a nun, presumably. I don't really familiar where he's doing it with the monks. And they're sitting there bearing pain and not reacting, bearing what's going on mindfully. We don't know whether the pain is physical or it's in their mind, but they're bearing it. And the Buddha just says, bear it, brother, bear it, monk. And there is a great virtue in being able to bear what comes at you. Shantideva lists all the different things that you might have to face, even quite quite difficult things. It might be that as a bodhisattva you get into situations where you might be threatened or even experience beatings or imprisonment or something like that after going through all the things like gnats and illness and a great itch and all that sort of thing. You've got to bear all that. Don't be squeamish. Don't be squeamish in relation to all that. Gosh, that's quite something. It's interesting with Kshanti. You have to have a strong mind to practice Kshanti. And he says that, mind, be strong, be firm. The word is drudha. Be strong and firm. It is interesting, though, I think that one of the great strengths of Buddhism, of course, is it's, you know, it asks us to really examine our mind. But there is a sort of near enemy to that, and that is obsessing over those things that make us feel comfortable. You hear so many concerns and worries about cold, about heat, about food, about diet, about drink, about bedroom arrangements. It's not good enough. That's not good enough. I don't like this retreat. I don't like this training. This doesn't suit me. And that is such a long way from the bodhisattva path. That's such a long way from it. We really need to be developing in our training so much more robustness that we can bear discomfort and pain and even terror if necessary, to even to get into situations which could be very, very frightening. I mean, I've certainly been in a few very frightening situations in India when I was involved in communicating the Dharma. I could have thought, well, I'm not going to go to India in the first place because I might get into those situations. But I want to do that because of the inspiration and adventure of the Dharma. And they're also quite sort of amusing situations. I remember being on a Dharma tour with Bodhi Sen, great Dharmachari in India when I lived in Bombay, and we were doing a tour of the coast in Maharashtra, and you know, we were staying in a room. It was hot, so it was the summertime. We kept the door open, and it was the place where we were staying was on the porch of this house, and so the door just opened out onto the backyard. And Bodhi Sen woke up in the morning laughing his head off because a mangy, flea-ridden dog had crawled under the blanket and snuggled up to him. I mean, I was absolutely horrified at this. Bodhi Sen thought this was hilarious. That's what you might have to put up with if you're on the path, if you're really trying to do something. You might end up with mangy dogs in your bed. And in verse 21, he says, the virtue of suffering has no rival, since from the shock it causes, intoxication falls away, and there arises compassion for those in cyclic existence, fear of evil and a longing for the conqueror. That's a brilliant little set. If you encounter suffering, you sober up. You know, you're not intoxicated anymore by life. You have to sober up. You have to develop some apramada. You become more compassionate with others. You know, if you suffer, you can start empathizing more profoundly with others. You develop fear in the sense of the fear of the causes that bring about suffering. And you develop a profound longing for enlightenment, a profound longing for the Buddha, the jina spriha, as he calls it, which means desiring eagerly. It's a very positive desire. It's not any ordinary craving. It's this longing for liberation from suffering. Shantideva goes on to then talk about the patience that consists in certainty with regard to the ultimate nature of things. So here Shantideva is bringing the vision of the Prajnaparamita itself, the perfection of wisdom, to others' anger and hatred, the wisdom perspective. As he said at the beginning of this section, you need to cultivate patience in many different ways. There isn't one way. There are many methods, many tools. And here he provides a sort of meditation, a kind of analytical meditation, an insight meditation, contemplation, which would be done on the basis of shamatha meditation. And he basically asks, who are you angry with? Because actually when you look at another person, there's just an assemblage of conditions that are ever changing. That's all there is. You know, he says, I feel no anger towards bile and the like, even though they cause intense suffering. Why then am I angry with sentient beings? They too become angry because of conditions. So he goes on in this way. He even arrives in the end at the vision of Maya. Maya, the illusory nature of everything. Yes, there's an appearance, but there is nothing substantial there. So who am I getting angry with? There's nothing to get angry with. You won't find something, you know, called harm that's really being done to you. There's just a set of conditions. And of course, this is the real test of insight, the real test of whether you have any insight, any wisdom. Can you actually see through your anger? Can you see through the acts that are being, you think are being done to you, which cause you anger? Just to hear what he says. As this sharp pain wells up, though unsought for, so though unsought for, wrath wells up against one's will. A person does not get angry at will, having decided, I will get angry, nor does anger well up after deciding, I shall well up. Whatever transgressions and evil deeds of various kinds there are, all arise through the power of conditioning factors. Nothing arises independently. Neither does the assemblage of conditioning factors have the thought, I shall produce. Nor does what is produced have the thought, I am produced. In this way, everything is dependent upon something else. Even that thing upon which each is dependent is not independent, since, like a magical display, phenomena do not initiate activity. At what does one get angry? Yes, so this is the real test of whether or not we have any real wisdom. You know, what does one get angry? There's nothing there to get angry with. And, of course, in the Bodhisattva tradition, the highest form of patience, which is a kind of wisdom, is the Anuttapataka Dharma Kshanti, the patient acceptance that all dharmas, all phenomena are unarisen, are unborn. This is very, very mysterious. At the beginning of this lockdown period, I found myself reflecting on this quite a lot, because a certain set of conditions, namely, sorry to call you conditions, namely people coming on retreat and me being in relation to you, were not arising. They were not arising. A great arising had been taken away. So I found myself reflecting upon this. Atisha says, when he talks about the goal of the spiritual life, the goal of the Dharma being the possession of the essence of voidness and compassion, he says that this arises in a non-arising kind of way through realizing the unborn nature of everything. The Anuttapataka Dharma Kshanti. And he says, when you experience that, when you experience the Maya nature of everything, when you see that, your body, speech and mind reacts with pleasure, like slipping fresh butter into barley soup. You melt, you soften, so there can only be love and compassion for those who don't have that liberation, who don't have that experience. So if you have anger and attachment, there is no realization. There is no insight. Or certainly the insight is not penetrating deeply enough. So in the end, if we're going to practice Kshanti, we have to aspire to, we have to realize the Maya nature of all beings. There is nothing to get angry with. There is nobody to get angry with. And yet there are people who are suffering, who you have to respond to. This can be misused, this argument. It's very interesting in Shantideva. He's always careful to make sure people don't give themselves loopholes. So he says, if it is argued that to resist anger is inappropriate, for who is it that resists that what? Our view is that it is appropriate. Since there is dependent origination, there can be cessation of suffering. Therefore, even if one sees a friend or an enemy behaving badly, one can reflect that there are specific conditioning factors that have made them like this and therefore remain happy. It's sometimes this word maya, the way it's used in Buddhist tradition is very different from how it's used in Hinduism. Bhante's made the point that the way maya can be used in Hinduism doesn't necessarily change anything. And he says he has known great Advaita Vedantins who observed caste and untouchability. But they would say that's all illusion. It might look like caste and untouchability, might be experienced as great discrimination towards people and oppression, but it's not really. That's all illusion, because ultimately things aren't like that. That is not the Buddhist view of maya. Maya really is another way of talking about pratitya samuppada, dependent origination. And of course, there are people suffering, undergoing dependent origination. You might be liberated yourself from the suffering of dependent origination, but of course you have compassion for others who are undergoing that suffering. So the Bodhisattva has this profound understanding of others, and therefore he can forgive. There's the great French saying, isn't there? To understand all is to forgive all, even without the teaching of Pratitya Samuppada. When we understand the pressures that people are under, we can forgive them. Our compassion can come in very, very, very strongly. So we can, you know, one way of practicing patience with other people, not giving into anger, is to understand people more deeply, understand the pressures that they're under. I sometimes think, though, that with this business of seeing everything as maya and shunyata, there's still problems in it for me. There's still problems of not really relating to people deeply enough and profoundly enough. And there's a teaching that Shantideva quotes in his Shiksha Samuchaya from a Mahayana Sutra on the three levels of loving kindness. And I must say, I find this a more, I suppose, accessible teaching. These three levels are loving kindness for people or persons or living beings, loving kindness for the flow of dharmas, and loving kindness for shunyata. They're not really three separate things, I think, but rather deeper levels of love and deeper levels of seeing people, of seeing life, of seeing living beings. Of course, we're very familiar with the love for people, the love for living beings. We do that in the Metta Bhavana. We really need to see them as living beings like ourselves. But as our loving kindness goes deeper, we see them as changing living beings, as a flow of ever-changing phenomena. They change in all sorts of ways. And if our love can be for that ever-changingness, it will be a more effective love, a deeper love. And of course, as we look more deeply, we begin to realize that another living being is inconceivable. There are no words to describe another living being. They are, in that sense, shunyata. It doesn't mean that they don't exist. It means that all our ideas about other living beings, about life, just don't obtain. They are there in all of their wonder. So I think I sort of prefer, as it were, this approach to the whole business of the wisdom aspect of relating to living beings. And of course, if you do have that love for the ever-changing nature and the inconceivability of living beings, you'll be profoundly patient and forgiving you'll understand on the deepest possible level, you know, what they're like and what can happen. I remember giving a talk where I first tried to express this, and Bhante was chairing the talks, and he said, yes, that was very interesting. I mean, Bhante, you know, didn't praise me or anything like that, didn't say, oh, what a wonderful talk, he said. It reminded me, he said, of something Lama Govinda said in one of his essays. Look deeper. Keep looking deeper into the nature of living beings. If you look deeper, you'll love more profoundly and more effectively. And we must remember in all of these passages, Shantideva isn't trying to be clever by bringing in the perfection of wisdom perspective. What he's trying to do is give us tools to rid us of our hatred and anger and retaliation. The next verses are all about making light of suffering, he says. So he says here, if it is their very nature to cause others distress, my anger towards those fools is as inappropriate as it would be towards fire for its nature to burn. In fact, their faults are adventitious. Beings are by nature pleasant. So anger towards them is inappropriate as it would be towards the sky if full of acrid smoke. His the knife and mine the body, the twofold cause of suffering. He has grasped the knife, I have grasped my body. At which is their anger? If I did retaliate, they would not be protected, and I would fail in my practice, with the result that those in torment would be lost. These are just a few verses of making light of suffering. He's trying to get a perspective on things. I think he's trying to be a bit humorous here, I wonder. This business sounds a bit harsh, doesn't it? If it is the very nature of others to cause distress to others, and I'm one of the others, my anger towards those fools, some people might not like the word fools. Bhante translates fools, bala, more kindly, as the spiritually immature. Sometimes it's translated as the childish, but the spiritually immature. Why get angry? That's what happens. People hurt each other. We've done it. So why get angry? That's so inappropriate. I remember quite the embarrassing story. I was leading a study group on an order convention with, I was a young novice private preceptor, and I put a lot of effort into preparing my study for my disciples, to use that language. I'm saying that lightly, humorously, the people I'd ordained. And I was really looking forward to it, and I put a lot into it. And they weren't that interested. They were bored or a bit reactive, a bit touchy. And I got really upset. And I remember, Arloka coming, we were passing. This is at Wyndham College. He said, are you okay? I said, I'm not okay. I'm really upset. And he said, well, why? And I said, why? And he said something, and I sort of walked away or something. I was pathetic, really, like a child whose sandcastle had been destroyed, which is an image that Shantideva uses later on. But we talked about it, and he said to me, yes, but what did you expect? What did you expect? Why are you having such high expectations? He didn't mean that, oh, these people are going to be like that. Well, they weren't in the mood. Why should they be in the mood, to study? Why get upset? Why not instead be more creative, more patient in relation to that? It's a very, very good, helpful, very obvious teaching, with such an immaturity on my part. And it's going to be like that sometimes. We put out a lot. We make a lot of effort to communicate the Dharma. People might not be interested. They might be indifferent, bored, irritated, reactive. And you've done your very, very best. If you then react to that in the way that I did, you're failing in your bodhisattva practice. You have to make light of it. This is what happens. This is the way it goes. We're in this situation. I'm one of the spiritually immature. Let's relax with that. We do our best. We do it for its own sake. And if people respond, they respond. If they don't, they don't. But we do it because it's good to do. He says as well, in fact, the faults of other people, even the faults of them hurting you, are adventitious, are gunta, incidental. Beings are actually pleasant. The word is peshala in Sanskrit, which can also mean beautiful, lovely, charming. I know that might be a bit of a challenge sometimes, but again, I think that's a great wisdom perspective. Beings are essentially beautiful. I think this is what the Buddha's vision of the lotus is. We have to look for that deeper beauty in people, ignoring the things that, you know, that are annoying us. Relate to that. Push through to that. Again, my beloved Sufis, the highest realization really for a great Sufi is to see the beloved, the beautiful, true beloved in each and every living thing, in each and every living creature. Everything is a reflection of that. So we need to be striving for that. And again, here we have this famous verse, controversial verse in some way. He takes the knife, I take the body. Who do you get angry with? You've brought the body. They might have brought the knife, but you've brought the body. You could just as equally get angry with that. You are embodied. You've been brought back here through your craving and your unskillfulness. So what are you really angry with? I mean, I must say I've never tried it. I've never tried that, using that argument. But perhaps we could also think of the knife or the stick, not just as a literal knife or stick, but the wounding word or something like that. Well, you know, you brought the ear, you brought the mind, that hears all that, that reacts to that. Who or what are you angry with? This should not be used as a rationalization to harm other people. It's interesting, in the endlessly fascinating Cry Bhante's comment on this, he does express a bit of concern about this kind of verse, you know, and he talks about, you know, the traditional high caste attitude to the so-called untouchable communities, that they just must suffer their karma of being born in that situation, and we'll help you suffer that by oppressing you and by beating you. You've taken the body, we're taking the stick. So that argument would not work in those kinds of contexts where there are, you know, where there is that kind of repression. And we have to be very, very careful, you know, with that kind of teaching, you know, when people are faced with such things. Shantideva uses many, many arguments to make light of suffering. He even goes so far as to say, it's actually through my patience that people are going to suffer more, because their hatred will take them to a really bad place after death. So I really need to have compassion for them, not be annoyed with them. In fact, they're helping me to grow and change on the path through the practice of patience, and they are suffering through that. So he's really trying to turn round and reverse all the normal ways that we look at things. I find this really, really challenging, I must say. Verse 51 says, if I did retaliate, they would not be protected, and I would fail in my practice, with the result that those in torment would be lost. Those in torment would be lost, you know, if I retaliated. In the Vimalakirti Nidesha, where it's talking about the Bodhisattva's great love, Vimalakirti says, the great love is the love that is kshanti, because it protects both self and other so as to avoid all injury. Kshanti protects self and other. It protects ourselves through not falling into anger and hatred. And we protect them from our reactivity. We protect them from our retaliation. So I think there's a wonderful way of thinking about kshanti. It's all-round protection for living beings. Shantideva's discussion of kshanti is very thorough and very subtle. I must say, a lot of his discussions are too subtle for me. But, you know, it's very, very clear. When you're a bodhisattva, you're really going to do something. You're really going to do something to benefit other people. And you will then encounter opposition. Don't avoid it. Face it. Don't give up acting with love. Act well in the face of disfavor. He says it's better to die than give up acting well in relation to other people, even though you're facing tremendous opposition and disfavor. It's very, very challenging the way he speaks. You know, I must admit, you know, I'm personally very, very dependent on being thought well of. And to the extent that is there, that limits that my capacity to benefit others. Shantideva also doesn't neglect people, the object of patience, people harming the most sacred and cherished things in our life. He says, if I can find it, and my hatred towards those who damage sacred images and stupas or who abuse the true teaching is inappropriate, since the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are not distressed. When people harm one's teachers, relatives and others dear to us, one should, as above, regard it as arising on the basis of conditioning factors and refrain from anger towards them. But realizing this, I shall make an effort to perform good actions in such a way that everyone will develop a heart of loving kindness towards each other. This is really, really crucial. There is no righteous indignation in Buddhism. Even if people are harming our most sacred objects, even if they're harming those who are near and dear to us, even if they're harming the Sangha, to respond with anger and hatred and violence and retaliation, you are breaking the Buddha's teaching. You are breaking the Bodhisattva path. This is very, very powerful. This is a very, very difficult, very profound teaching. I must admit, I think, though, that, you know, we probably don't get upset, perhaps enough, when the Dharma is attacked. And when our friends in the Sangha are attacked unjustly, I don't mean that we should respond with anger in those situations, of course not. But of course, it should affect us, it should touch us. We shouldn't have a kind of strange indifference to what we really cherish and care for. That's another extreme that can seem to mean that we don't really care. I think actually, where righteous indignation seems to be more present is in relation to people's deeply held and unquestioned ideologies. And I mean, I include Buddhists in that. There does seem to be a kind of culture at the moment of great polarization in the world. Almost everything seems to be politicized. And somebody steps out of what somebody regards as the right political line or the right social line. They are attacked mercilessly, even by so-called Buddhists. That isn't the practice of Shantiparamita. That is righteous indignation, because we're very attached to our particular views. So we really need to watch that. We need to watch out for the new forces of conscience, as Milton calls them in one of his sonnets. It doesn't mean, though, in relation to attacks on our friends and nearest and dearest and those we really admire and respect, it doesn't mean that we go passive. Kshanti isn't passivity. We can respond positively. Interestingly enough, Shantideva has no difficulty refuting wrong view in his text. He refutes in the Bodhicaryavatara the false views that he sees perpetrated by other traditions, either within the Buddhist tradition or outside of the Buddhist tradition. He doesn't see that as a contradiction to kshanti and tolerance. So we can also respond when we're attacked. I remember once going to see Bhante and I was very distressed. I was very upset, even angry, because friends of mine were being publicly criticised in our order journal. This was many, many years ago. Close friends of mine, including Bhante himself. And I said I thought it was unskillful, my response, and I should just keep quiet. And he said, well, no, you can't really do that. He said, because there's energy there. There's energy there. But he said, you don't need to reactively respond. He said, what you could do when it comes to your turn to write into the order journal, just rejoice in the merits of the people who are criticised. You don't have to get into an argument about them. You just rejoice in them. You express your pleasure at the good that they have done. So there are skillful ways of responding, you know, to when those we cherish and love are under attack. So we're coming towards the end of the talk now. Just a few more things to get through. Shantideva also has sections on having patience for people who do good to our enemies. And in this section, it's very, very interesting, he's particularly concerned with the theme of envy, our envy and our jealousy. Just a few from these verses. If others take pleasure and joy in praising the strength of someone's virtues, why, mind, do you not similarly rejoice in praising it? After arousing the bodhicitta out of the desire for the happiness of every being, why are you angry at them now that they have found happiness for themselves? You desire Buddhahood, which is worthy of worship throughout the three worlds, expressly for living beings. Why do you burn inside on seeing them have some slight honour? A very interesting passage. You do wonder, again, this is one of the reasons why Shantideva can be quite popular, because he can talk about something that we recognise. Let's face it, people can be envious of other people within the spiritual community. People do get envious of other people's spiritual success. They do, or what they regard as people's, you know, better status or something like that. And perhaps sometimes we don't even like to admit that we feel envious. We'd much rather sort of find ways of criticizing them, you know, when we have that envy, when we make that negative comparison with them. You know, it does happen. We do burn sometimes when someone, even a friend, is rejoiced in and does well. We do need to own this. We do need to be honest about it. We really need to get to grips with it and not pretend that it's something else. Envy, I think, is incredibly corrosive. And I think it's probably more pervasive than we perhaps realise. And it's the total opposite of what we vowed to do. Shantideva is saying, I have vowed for the liberation of all beings. I want all beings to have the highest happiness. And yet I resent that person who has some success and happiness and who is admired and rejoiced in. What a contradiction. What a contradiction. I think it's brilliant he says that, because he's saying, look, the bodhisattva vow has got to come in relationship to these very base emotions. If it doesn't come in relationship to these base emotions, it's worthless. It's just sentimentality. It's got to come into relationship to them. I think very often we over-personalise happiness. If someone has joy and happiness and spiritual success, well, they've got it and I haven't. But it's such a weird state of mind, isn't it? Because actually their happiness is happiness for everyone. It's happiness coming into the world. There isn't actually that separation between ourselves and others. So if we rejoice in it, they've made us happy. We are increasing the happiness with the rejoicing. Greater happiness greater qualities are coming into the world through the Punyana Modana. So we really need to practice kshanti in relation to the successes of others. It's a great little aphorism of Bhante in Pieces of Fire. It is easy to forgive people their vices. What is sometimes more difficult is to forgive them their virtues. Sometimes we won't forgive people their virtues. Shantideva's discussion of patience builds and grows to a point where he can say that those who harm us, our enemies, are our greatest friends and teachers, worthy of our deepest reverence. When I first saw an interview with the Dalai Lama on his first visit to England in the 1970s, I was still living with my parents. I was quite shocked when he was asked about his attitude to Chairman Mao. He said, well, I think he's my greatest friend. He is my greatest teacher. And the interviewer, you could see, was completely stunned and baffled. Well, why? Because he teaches me patience. He teaches me love. And of course, I had no awareness of Shantideva then. But this is straight out of classic Bodhisattva practice. And he meant it. You could see that he meant it. You know, the Dalai Lama, with that deep care and connection to the Tibetan people, he's not saying that lightly. He is my greatest teacher and friend because he's teaching me the most profound patience. It's an incredible thing to say. You know, after all, friends who praise us, who love us, Shantideva says, well, they'll actually destroy our sangvega, as it's called. Sangvega means our sense of urgency. We become comfortable with our friends and complacent. So we don't grow and we don't really change. I don't think we need to go and seek out enemies. I wouldn't recommend that. I think just being in the Sangha together is enough. Not that I mean that the Sangha I mean is full of enemies, but it's challenging enough just being thrown together with people who are very different from ourselves, or even worse, rather like ourselves. You know, we've got to really change and respond and practice in relation, to them. And there's that great story, isn't there, of a teacher taking that very rough chai servant or that attendant with him who was very rude and unpleasant because he wanted to really test his bodhicitta. And the second visit to Tibet, he wasn't with him because he said he didn't need that attendant because the Tibetans gave him enough, tests for his practice of bodhicitta, a practice of patience. So Shantideva reverses all the usual ways of seeing and evaluating. It is really in dependence upon his malign attention that patience is produced. And in that case, it is really he that is the cause of patience. I must worship him as the true Dharma. For this reason, the sage has said, the Buddha has said, that the fertile field of living beings is the fertile field of the conquerors, because many have reached success and spiritual perfection by honouring them. The lords of sages become joyful at the happiness of living beings, at whose distress they are sorrowful. To satisfy these creatures is to satisfy the lords of sages. To offend them is to offend the sages too. Now, to honour the Tathagatas with my entire self, I become a servant to the world. Let streams of people place their foot upon my head or strike me down. Let the Lord of the world be satisfied. That there is no doubt that those whose selfhood is compassion have taken this entire world for themselves. Is it not the case that they appear in the form of these good people? It is these people who are the Lords. How can I be disrespectful? This alone is the honouring of the Tathagatas. This alone is the fulfilment of my own goal. This alone beats back the suffering of the world. So let this alone be my vow. So Shantideva is turning, as I say, everything around. He's bringing all living beings, especially enemies, up to the level of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. He's identifying all living beings with the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So he really needs to revere all living beings, especially those who would cause him harm. This is an extraordinarily profound vision, because Shantideva has the deepest possible reverence and faith and devotion towards the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. This really is a sacred outlook on all life. In the Vimalakirti Nidesha, Vimalakirti says, only a Bodhisattva can harass another Bodhisattva. So all the Maras, all the enemies, all the people that would harm a Bodhisattva are just Bodhisattvas in disguise, taking the form of those terrible things to teach and help the Bodhisattva develop patience and all the other qualities and virtues that are needed. So think of people who you really dislike, people in your family, people in the Sangha. Yes, think of your favourite politicians who you hate. They're just Bodhisattvas in disguise. That's all they are. They're just teaching you something. They need to be honoured. They really do. I know this sounds, in relation to some characters, I'm sure you think, I am not doing that, but I'm just passing on what Shantideva says. You know, so Donald Trump, next time he comes on, what are you going to do? What am I going to do? Or whoever your particular bugbear is. Shantideva's last words are these, and we'll finish with them. His final words on Kshantiparamita. Never mind future Buddhahood arising from the honouring of living beings. Do you not see good fortune, renown, and well-being right here and now? Through patience comes serenity, freedom from disease, joy, and long life, the happiness of the universal monarch, prosperity. These the patient person receives while continuing in cyclic existence. Thank you.